another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artist by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on WeDigPodcasts.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast. Hello, welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Colin, and with me as usual are my comrades and co-hosts, Ian.
Hello.
And Tracy.
Hello.
It's the letter W.
What?
Double woo.
What?
Wit.
What?
So, which also begins with W.
It does.
Ooh, will. Yeah. Also begins with a W. We will be talking about
Wittering about
the wedding present.
Woo.
Tang Clan. And the Wu-Tang Clan. But first of all, I believe Tracy is going to tell us about the wedding present.
Oh, why do you catch my eye then turn away? We said all the things we had to say. Sean said he saw you holding hands with your new friend. How does it feel to know you just won again? Don't give me that, it's the worst thing. Everyone thinks he looks daft, but you can have your train.
Thank you for that enthusiastic introduction, Colin.
I'm only going to get more enthusiastic, I'm sure.
I know you are. So, The Wedding Present are an indie band formed in 1985 in Leeds. The original lineup was David Gedge on guitar and vocals, Keith Gregory on bass, Peter Saloka on guitar, and Sean Charman on drums. The lineup's changed so many times since then, though.
It's basically Gedge and your granny on bongos, isn't it?
It is Gedge and your granny on bongos. The current drummer, though, Charlie Layton, actually has been with them 10 years now, so longer than any other member of any lineup. And the current guitarist and bassist, respectively, Danielle Wadey and Melanie Howard, were both previously members of Gedge's side project band, Cinerama.
Okay.
So they
wasn't either the guitarist originally the bass player or the bass player originally the guitarist?
Yeah, Danielle was the bassist, and then the guitarist left after they finished up the George Best anniversary tour.
Right.
He's Australian, he's gone back home, and so she's moved over to guitar.
Yeah, because he was the guy, because they've got a guy on guitar, isn't
it? Yeah. And so she's moved over to guitar, and Melanie's moved from Cinerama bass to Wedding Present. So, they have released 9 studio albums and 20-plus singles and EPs over the years. They were championed by John Peel right from the start, right from their first single.
Nobody's infallible.
Peel will tell you you're wrong. The quote from Peel in 1999.
Yes, I know.
Yep. The boy Gedge has written some of the best love songs of the rock and roll era. You may dispute this, but I'm right and you are wrong.
Yeah, but he's... No, I'm sorry.
But
I'm the one that's still alive.
Strangely, the first time I heard them wasn't on Peel, though.
It's a bit low, dude.
Yeah, that was a bit low. Take that back.
Sorry.
Strangely, I didn't hear them first on Peel, though. I heard them on The Chart Show, which was the ITV rival show for Top of the Pops.
I remember The Chart Show.
Yeah, yeah. So in 88, they played one of their early singles, Nobody's Twisting Your Arm, and I'm fairly sure that's the first time I'd have heard The Wedding Present.
Okay. Because didn't... I was going to wonder whether that was when... Because didn't they do... released like a single every month for a year that wasn't on an album until they put them on a compilation.
That wasn't until 1992.
Though. Oh, right.
Hit Parade.
Fair enough.
And in actual fact, I really only have very hazy memories of that happening. I mean, 92 going to 93 would have been my final year of university, so I don't know. I wasn't studying hard. Maybe I was just too drunk to remember.
Right. So my memories of The Wedding Present are... I haven't really got any. I did once describe David Gedge as the Little Morrissey on Twitter, and he immediately followed me, which, fair play, that's fucking hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell that he likes Morrissey vocally. He's definitely trying.
I'm not sure. I think that he's from Manchester as well. He's in an indie band because he's from Manchester and then moved across to Leeds.
I'd see a greater line of influence with Marquis Smith than Morrissey, to be honest.
I'd rather listen to Marquis Smith. The Fall are a lot more interesting and the Smiths are a lot more interesting. But I do know that they're a band that are absolutely loved by absolutely shitloads of people. They really do mean a lot to people. And I know Peel was a massive fan, but I was trying to work out why I don't get them and what it is that I'm missing. I think partially it's because I'm too young. People that are like around 10 years older than me, like you're not far off 10 years older than me, are...
What year were you born?
82.
Oh.
So you're...
9 years older.
50 years older than me. When George Best came out, what was that, 86?
87,
so I was 5. So I'm not the target audience there at
me
all.
Me neither.
So Ian was 9 then, I think.
82?
No, it came out in 87.
87, 7, 8, 9.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ian wouldn't be the target audience even if he was 18 at the time.
No.
Because he'd have been listening to thrash metal at that point. I think they caught people when they were at the right age and stuck with them.
Yeah.
Whereas, because I wasn't at that age, they were already... Yeah, they were still releasing albums in the mid-90s, but there wasn't much left because he was basically jacking it in and going to Cinerama about that point, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I was reading Enemy and Melody Maker in the mid to late 90s, I think they'd kind of seen The Wedding Present as past it.
Yeah, well...
So wouldn't have given much coverage.
The Wedding Present album, Saturnalia, was 1996, and then they didn't release another album as The Wedding Present until 2005.
Yeah.
So a 9-year gap of Wedding Present albums, and in between that, yeah, there was Cinerama. You'd have missed the window, I guess.
I completely passed me by. I'd got... there was a compilation CD that I've got called Crash Indie Anthems that I used to use for DJ a fair bit, that came out in about 2003-ish, that had got Kennedy on it. And I also had a Mojo magazine free CD of John Peel favourites that had got Everyone Thinks He Looks Daft on it,
which is the opener from...
And, and both tracks had never really sort of grabbed me. George Best, obviously, it's wrong-footed me from the start by being named after a footballer, and I really fucking hate football. So that's good.
No, that did it to me when I was doing my research earlier today.
It's nothing to do with football, though.
But then Bizarro is named after a really awesome character from Superman comics. Bizarro is the backwards version of Superman.
Yes.
Where he's trying to help people, but basically making things much worse.
Yeah. Strangely.
But I still don't like that album.
As I said in the 1999 special edition we did, from around 95 through to maybe about 2005, I wasn't really listening to a lot of new music, so I didn't pick up on a lot of these Wedding Present albums as they came out. It's much later that I've gone back and re-listened to everything.
But they were designed for your old genetics.
Oh God, were they fucking ever.
See, that's it. It's like if I picked up a Nokia phone charger. I don't have a phone that would plug into.
So it's not designed for it.
This is the same thing, right?
So the wedding present released songs that, yes, definitely plug into parts of me.
Oh God, that was a metaphor that I made happen.
I'm really fucking sorry about that. Walked into that. I mean, the thing about
fucking hell.
So, well, less said about you getting David Gedge plugged into you, the better.
I'm afraid there'll be lots of it. I mean, the thing is, he writes the most amazingly heartfelt love songs, and they just speak to me. But unlike Morrissey, that you've compared him to, he doesn't write these wry...
Less gammony.
He doesn't.
Oh, fuck yes.
He doesn't write clever, flowery, poetic lyrics. He's got a very conversational style. He just says what he's thinking. He wears his heart on his sleeve. And it's really endearing. He's the master of the breakup song. And like I think I've said with Malcolm Middleton, with Gerard Love, the more he has his heart broken, the more I love him.
And so you hate him, basically.
No,
if you're listening, man, because you possibly might be, she wants you to be sad.
Is that
a way for a fan to think?
But it's more
terrible
than that, because... His lyrics have a lot of sexual references, a lot of... Even ones where there's relationships where he is the cheater rather than the cheatee, I still...
Seems to be a lot like that, I've noticed.
I still love him and want him. and when he's got sexual references, which is fairly often, it doesn't seem vulgar. Even if he's like calling out a woman's name when he comes, he makes it sound romantic, desirable. Examples.
Oh, fucking hell, do we need them?
Examples.
I require them. I want to hear his non-vulgar war face references.
From Saturnalia in 96, actually, there were three on there with really overtly sexual lyrics.
Go on then.
So, I mean, he's got a lyric in The Real Thing, says, I love watching you when you come.
Right.
On Kansas, there's the lines, push your fingers deep inside, don't stop until you're satisfied.
Okay.
And then the first one I referenced about, and then as I came, I cried out your name, from the song 50s. And when he says them, they're swoony, not sexual. I mean, I guess it's fair to say that I totally would.
You say that. I'd also, in that... Tracy lent me a documentary that I've completely blanked on the name of about the...
Something Left
George
Behind.
Bessner, Something Left Behind. Double Tracy likingness in that video, because John Robb's in it a fair bit being interviewed as
well.
Yeah. So anyway... I wanted to understand what people that love this band like about them.
Yes.
So I copied Tracy and I took to Twitter.
I
put a message up.
I purposely didn't respond to it, although I did read everybody else's responses.
So did I, actually. I purposefully didn't give any reactions.
No.
So, apart from a couple of asking follow-up questions, I put, wedding present, loads of you lot love them, but I really have trouble seeing the appeal. What am I missing? Why do you love them so much? Is it a generational thing? Are there many fans under 40 out there? So, first of all, that last bit, any fans under 40, we had two responses from people under 40. Oscar put 23 and I love them if you want to consider me for any statistics. Fair enough. Is it Ewan or Evan?
Ewan,
because it's E-V-V-A-N on Twitter.
He takes that from the band Always.
Oh, of course, yes. Right, which is Keith's son. He's put 20 years old, love the wedding present, can't listen to George Best or Bizarro without dancing around the room thinking, should I call up my ex-girlfriend I haven't spoken to in 4 years? Probably not. Don't do it. Also, just perfect C86 on 4x speed. To be fair, probably a bit of your dad's influence on that one. Because I love Jimi Hendrix because I grew up listening to it. If you grow up listening to something, that's going to sort of influence what you like later on. But
in Oscar's case, I don't think it would have been very
not necessarily.
his parents are really into jazz.
Well, and well, Oscar, we know he's a very big Jesus and Mary Chain fan, so it's the mid 80s stuff is Oscar's kind of wheelhouse, isn't it?
So
going back to the relatable stuff, I got loads of comments about how relatable the lyrics are. Gareth, who does the Yesterday's Jam podcast.
Also, did you know that his Twitter handle, The Edge of the Sea, is actually a wedding present reference?
I didn't, but okay. I know he's a massive fan because he's written a like big long blog web
yes, he has.
Site thingy about it. Not sure if it's generational with the Weddos, but I think growing up with them helped. Gedge's songs are full of disastrous relationships, heartbreaking, backstabbing women that just seem to be like my real life throughout my late teens and 20s, so relatability key for me. David Bruce said, first of all, the very bold claim, they were better than the Smiths, that's all you need to know. And I was like, you're going to need to elaborate on
which
that.
Which really pissed off Keith.
He put, they were more relatable to me, something about the way Gedge wrote, more honest, more everyman, situations I've been in, furious guitars, great songwriting, except Kennedy, of course, that's shit. One more point, you could happily have a pint with Gedge, which seems, that seems to come up a fair bit.
I legit didn't hear any guitars that I would describe as furious.
I'm definitely going to get into that. I have that in my notes.
Like mid-paced is how I'd describe them.
I wouldn't say mid-paced. They're very fast in places.
Are they?
But yeah.
I must have missed that.
Relatable, another bit. Keith is a response to that, which is a pretty good, cool quote, this. The Smiths soundtrack perfectly the bit where I thought life would be complete if I could meet girls, and the wedding present the bit where I did and it wasn't.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Gareth actually said in another post to me on something else that he said, if you believe Gedge's songs, he must have had hundreds of girlfriends. How is that possible? But I think it's entirely possible because I mean,
well, of course you do.
Well, I fall utterly in love with him when I listen to his words, and you know, and if that's an indication of him as a lover, then yeah, he'll easily have women falling at his feet,
and then cheat on them with other women.
He's definitely talked about that in some songs.
It works both
Girl
ways.
Girl from the DDR, in particular, being an example. But
maybe the everyman nature of his lyrics is why I didn't like them then.
It's quite possible, yeah.
I mean, that's definitely one of the things that turns me off. Is like, if it's just a bit
just
fucking
normal
soap opera-y, like if it's a bit EastEnders and Council Estate, I'm just not down.
You said that about films before. You said you're not that keen on like British films because they seem to be sort of realistic and
that's it. You're
like, not
escapism. Hill kind of.
Grow up on a council estate, you don't really want to watch films about council estates. Like here's a film about how shit a council estate
I
is.
Think you.
I know.
Talking more Shane Meadows kind of stuff than like This Is England, aren't you? Rather than. You know, Notting Hill and that kind of
thing. Yes.
Because that Notting Hill is not a council estate.
As an experiment to break out of my usual list of words, of just calling something beautiful or swoony, and beyond the simple.
Did you buy a thesaurus?
No, I just thought about some of the songs and thought about the other emotions he's covering. So you've got bitter and bittersweet, you've got lovelorn, forlorn, defiant, spiteful, hateful, regretful, pensive, romantic, horny, jubilant, and so much more. It just covers all emotion.
One of my favourite quotes, though, that I got, particularly about the age thing, Francois Sky says, I'm 52 and I still don't like anything from them, if this helps. But then you've got Matt P said, without them, I wouldn't be here. Bit dark, sorry, but that's how much they've helped me throughout my life. They're a band that really, really connect to people. And through everything, Gedge does seem to be a really, really sound bloke. There's a lot of people talking about how he's, you know, always make himself available for fans to talk to.
He runs his own merch store.
Yeah.
So he's always on the merch store before and after the gig.
And I've listened to a few interviews with him on podcasts, and he really does seem like a nice guy. So when I compared him to Morrissey,
I didn't have the knowledge.
I'm going to apologise for that. So I'm very sorry about that. Because, he seems like a nice guy.
My comparison was only just
cunt.
Voice tone. Voice tone related, not politics related. So, you know.
So, see, I was trying to work out what I don't like about it.
And you've always said it's his voice, haven't you?
Partially. I think some of his voice I'm not that keen on. But then it really struck me the other day that there's this one guitar rhythm that he keeps coming back to over and over
God,
again.
Oh, God, yes. All of the songs, like the first few songs on the playlist, just blended into one.
It's the
massive wall of beigeness at this tempo that always upsets me, because it's like, you're not trying to be slow, you're not trying to be fast. It's really uncomfortable for me to listen to, because it's just beige.
The rhythm I have written here is dan dan diggy da dan da dan diggy diggy.
Yeah.
Which is, there were so many songs that are just that exact strumming rhythm. Mm. And now every time I hear that rhythm, it makes me go, no, not listening to another one like that.
They used to have a t-shirt that said all the songs sound the same.
Yeah.
I imagine if you like that sound, then you're fucking golden. But
yeah.
What it reminds me of is George Formby playing his fucking banjolele. It's a fucking banjolele rhythm is what that is.
Yeah, I see that.
And in this, so in the documentary, like Ian was saying, that there's, you've got people using words to describe the band like aggressive, abrasive, angry, ferocious. These dudes haven't heard Sepultura. They've not heard Fear Factory.
We're talking in relative terms. We're talking indie ferociousness.
To us, they're not ferocious at all. They're not aggressive. They're not angry.
Yeah.
No, they're not
peeved.
Angry, but there's a ferocity.
But that's what people were saying to describe them.
There's a furiousness to the guitar sound. They were always of the belief that vocals should be quiet, guitars should be loud in their music, which isn't the balance you'd often get in indie.
Yeah, fair enough.
They've got fairly fast drums for indie songs.
There's a bit in the documentary where there's, I can't remember which track off George Best it is, but there's one that's, like Ian was saying, the guitars are kind of mid-paced, but there was one where the strumming speed is ridiculously fast. The Australian guitarist was saying he was really nervous when he first joined, because he didn't think that he'd have the stamina to keep up that speed all the way through, and then was really relieved when he joined the band and found out that Gedge plays that part, so he just has to play other guitar bits. But one bit that really annoyed me, there's an actor that keeps turning up. He's a Tony somebody or other, I think. He's the teacher out of Fresh Meat. He claims that George Best is the greatest breakup album of all time, which shows he has never heard
Disintegration by The Cure,
Forever, Forever Ago, Rid of Me, Blood on the Tracks, Rumours, Hear My Dear, Sea Change, Ladies and Gentlemen Floating in Space, A Moon-Shaped Pool, Shoot Out the Lights, The Boatman's Call. That's 11 now Ian adding Disintegration.
How the hell did you not have Disintegration?
Because I don't think of Disintegration as a breakup album, because Robert Smith has never broken up with his girlfriend.
But it sounds like a breakup album. It's called Disintegration, for fuck's sake. Disintegration, the song itself, is definitely about breaking up with someone.
I mean, John
Just because he hasn't done it doesn't mean he can't think about it.
But it can't be the greatest breakup album of all time when Forever, Forever Ago is in there above it, when Blood on the Tracks is in there.
Yeah.
I mean, John Robb in that documentary calls...
I knew you'd concentrate on that bit.
it says it's one of the classic...
Who is he?
He was in Goldblade, you'll know him from.
He's the singer of the Membranes.
Yeah, but you know him from Goldblade.
I knew the name.
He's a journalist as well.
He does
He
does the Louder Than War site.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've paid attention to that.
Okay.
Never even heard of it, sorry.
Okay. I mean, Gedge and Rob had become friends because Gedge really liked the Membranes, and Gedge could never understand how Peel didn't give the Membranes the same attention that he gave the Wedding Present, because they were kind of very similar, and the Membranes could have been much bigger. I mean, they're a great band.
In one of the podcast interviews that I heard, there was a bit where Gedge was saying that he did always feel a little bit guilty that John Peel was a bit like a gatekeeper.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And the bands that he
could make or break you.
But if he didn't promote that kind of band, then they weren't going to get anywhere.
It's true. I mean, you know, because, you know, pre-internet, pre-YouTube.
Getting a Peel session was a gateway to getting you a tour.
And pre-MTV, you know, it was the best way.
Well, these bands wouldn't necessarily be played on MTV anyway. Yeah. It's the more underground than that.
But I mean, what would anyway? Rob called the George Best a classic '80s indie album. He said it was a template album, and in terms of, you know, that period of indie, it's definitely true.
Yeah.
I mean, I adore the album. Well, I adore all of their albums, but
are you ready for the shocking plot twist?
Go on.
I have a narrative arc.
Oh, go on.
Take Fountain.
Mm-hmm.
What a fucking brilliant album.
Now, strangely, that one was originally intended to be Cinerama's fourth album, but then Gedge split up with
But I don't like the Cinerama records.
Oh, do you not?
Now I gave him a listen.
Cinerama was his side project where he wanted to do something more lush, more orchestral, kind of Burt Bacharach arrangements.
Right, okay.
But Take Fountain was slightly darker than anything Cinerama.
Is that that track that I was listening to when you arrived with actual guitars on it?
No, that's from Going Going, their 2016 album.
But that's after that. So,
which I actually thought liked, was all right.
Yeah.
That's Broken Bow.
Was it 2005, yes. Take Fountain?
It was.
Yeah, so Take Fountain was supposed to be a Cinerama album. Like we've said before, it's... If Gedge decides it's the wedding present, then it's the wedding present, because it doesn't matter who else
is
in the band.
Cinerama disintegrated because he split up with Sally Morell, who he'd formed it with and was his girlfriend.
So. And Take Fountain is a breakup album about that. There's a lot of lyrics about
very much so. She's singing on it.
Never be in a band with your girlfriend. Never. Never do it. Don't do it.
It's all right to be in a band with your ex-girlfriend, though, because she's a good finance.
But it's weird because Take Fountain has got breakup, but it's also got songs of pure joy and adoration. I mean, Perfect Blue, what a fucking song.
But on the opening track, Interstate 5.
Interstate 5.
It's about 8 minutes long, and it's fucking brilliant. Gedge's vocals are excellent. It's like he's... I don't know if he took singing lessons or something, but he's so much more on key. That he sounds more confident with it than he's ever been before. The guitars sound great. The guitars sound massive in some parts on that record. Production's really good. His vocals... I worked out what they remind me of on Take Fountain, where I like them. It's two bands that I like that aren't necessarily that well-liked. Rialto and Ultrasound.
Okay.
Both sort of late 90s indie type bands. A bit of the guitars remind me of that as well, because it's a little bit heading towards prog influenced. There's no like time signature changes and that kind of thing, but it's a more it seems like a more intelligent album. And I mean the other records after that, Valentina, I didn't like El Rey.
Did you not? My favourite.
It's an Albini produced one.
It is.
So I thought, oh great, it's after They've Got Good and it's an Albini produced one, I'll listen to it. And I think Albini probably, I don't know if he's encouraged them to get back to the earlier stuff, or they thought we're recording with Albini again, we'll go back to the older sound.
Because their third album was also produced by
There's definitely...
And they'd done a few EPs before then.
Dan Dan Diggy Da Dan Da Dan Diggy Diggy turns up again on that album, and so I was like, skipped it.
I mean, Albini liked working with them. He said Gage just knows what he wants in the studio. He says, right, these are the songs, this is how we're going to do it. Here's my lyrics, and this is how I like my tea. and he just said, you know, for an Englishman, he's sort of quite direct. And so he did enjoy working with him.
And then, so Valentina's got some good tracks. The Girl from the DDR that I mentioned earlier is a really good track.
Yeah.
And Going Going, the first couple of tracks are instrumental and I really like them, but then when the vocals
kind of experimental.
Yeah.
So Going Going actually was a multimedia thing.
There's films for each track,
yeah,
isn't
which
it?
They released on a DVD that came with the album. They're not films in that they have any kind of narrative. They're just kind of like...
They're visuals.
Cinematic visuals. Really beautifully done.
Are they... I just say I meant to try and have a look, but I didn't have time.
I wish I'd lent you that as well.
Are they... Because the album's based on a drive across America,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
So are the visuals anything to do with that, or are they a bit
more
abstract?
Absolutely, especially when you get to something like Two Bridges.
Right.
They're slightly abstract because some of it you wouldn't relate. It's not somewhere like, you know, oh, you'd go, oh, that's New York or something, because you've kind of got like there's one where you're just watching rainfall in a puddle for three minutes, which is beautiful, but it doesn't tell a story such. It's just a moment. Interestingly, how Take Fountain was a Cinerama album, which became a wedding present album. Valentina, was released in 2012. In 2015, Cinerama covered the album completely as Cinerama.
I thought so, because I looked on Spotify and they had an album called Valentina.
Yeah, and it's kind of like almost like a swing lounge jazz version of it.
Right.
Which is odd, but it really worked. It's kind of like, you know, when Paul Anka did a cover of Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit?
Yes.
Yeah.
Richard Cheese, who did a lot of... new metal songs and stuff in a lounge.
Right.
Mm.
But it really works. The arrangements are beautiful. I don't like it as much as Valentina itself, but...
But I've actually ended up from this going from being the band that we've referred to a few times as that band that Colin hates, to I've got Take Fountain in my Discogs list.
Wow.
To get the vinyl.
It's gorgeous. Mars sparkles down on me. Oh, it's so perfect. I could cry with joy.
What I'm hoping that they do is next year is 15 years since it's been released. So they've done Bizarro and George Best anniversary tours.
Yeah.
If they do a Take Fountain tour, I will go.
Mm.
Absolutely. I will definitely be there.
Wow.
So do that.
Also, I had... So we talked about the themes that are recurring themes throughout Wedding Present songs. And I've got a little quiz for our listeners, actually. I've taken one of their albums and just extracted the theme of each of them. And this is the themes. And I want to see if our listeners can guess which album this is.
We're 2C.
So the songs go like this. Cheating on his girlfriend. Girlfriend leaving him. Regret after a breakup. One night stand, him using her. Another breakup. Thinking about cheating but not actually cheating. Obsessively admiring someone from afar. One night stand, her using him. Fancying his friend's girlfriend. Still in love with his ex-girlfriend. And pissed off that his girlfriend's flirting with other men.
Is the answer...
Which album is that?
Is the answer all of them?
But that's the actual sequence of one album.
Okay.
So,
yeah. I think what you want people to do is send us your answers on Twitter.
Yes.
And you won't get a prize.
No.
The prize is knowing that you have been correct.
Yes.
The prize is, do I get a night with David Gedge? No?
Let's see what Tim says.
Yes! Does Tim listen to the podcast?
No,
fair enough. Probably for the best.
Good job, because you're always so fucking thirsty on it.
Anyway, I think we should probably wrap that up there.
Yep.
Okay.
And Ian, tell us about the Wu-Tang Clan.
I will.
Shaolin shadow boxing and the Wu-Tang sword style. If what you say is true, the Shaolin and the Wu-Tang could be dangerous. Do you think your Wu-Tang sword can defeat me?
On guard. I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
Bring the motherfucking ruckus! Bring the motherfucking ruckus! Bring the motherfucking ruckus! Bring the motherfucking ruckus!
Ghost face, catch the blast of a hype verse. My clock burst, leaving a hearse. I did worse, I come rough, tough like an elephant tusk. Your head rush, fly like Egyptian musk. Aw, shit, Wu-Tang Clan spark the Wixen. However, I mastered a trick, just like Nixon, causing terror.
So, Wu-Tang Clan, who, as we've discovered, or will discover, ain't nothing to fuck with.
This is true, because the Killer Bees gun swarm.
Yes. Formed in 1991, straight from the slums of Shaolin, Staten Island. The RZA, the Jizza, Method Man, Raekwon the Chef, Ghostface Killer, Inspector Deck, U-God, Master Killer, Old Dirty Bastard, R.I.P., and now Capadonna.
Yes. He was an unofficial 10th member until 2007, when he was officially a member.
Yes. Seems to have done no albums. He's appeared on a lot, but none of his own.
I think he may have done one, but...
Nothing on Spotify.
No.
I couldn't see it out. I was looking.
Wu-Tang Clan's discography is sprawling and ridiculous, because it's not just the Wu-Tang Clan. It's their own solo albums. It's also the Killer Bees, which is their affiliated act.
Yep.
And then there's just... It's like...
They're like a proper
entire family tree.
Corporation, yes. Really, because there's like clothing lines,
Woo-wear.
Film productions,
Woo films, probably.
It's like Zoo York is
Woovies.
A Woo related.
Should be Woovies.
Should be. So yeah, let's get into it
with the list of names. I mean, it probably wouldn't be quite as interesting if you just said Robert, Gary, Russell, Clifford, Corey, Dennis, Jason, Lamont, Elgin, and Daryl.
No, less impressive.
Yes.
Yeah. The moment I said the RZA, the jizz, I was like, God damn, that's cool. That's what.
The Rakim as well.
Raekwon the chef.
No, Prince Rakim is one of the RZA's alter egos.
Okay.
Yes, the RZA has multiple.
It's not the same Rakim as Eric B. and Rakim, who did Paid in Full.
Okay.
If you haven't heard 36 Chambers, it's one of the best hip hop albums ever.
Fuck yes.
Listen to it immediately.
Which was it 93?
That
was released, I believe.
Yes, I believe it was. 92.
92. So there's nine of them, but they weren't all necessarily there at the time of recording that. They're not all always on each album.
No, and they're not all always on each song.
No, and they're not all always not in jail.
But it is often the RZA.
Yeah, because 36 Chambers, U God and Master Killer were both in jail for the majority of the recording, so they've only got a couple of verses here and there.
Yeah.
They're
both on Protect Your Neck.
They are, indeed. Which is... I mean, there's so many classics on that album.
Yes.
Cream, Cash Rules Everything Around Me.
Method Man.
M-O-T-H-O-D, Man.
Yes. Who is your favourite member of the Wu-Tang Clan?
My favourite is... it's an obvious choice, I think. ODB.
Oh, really?
Old Dirty Bastard.
I'm going ODB.
Method Man is fucking fantastic. But ODB, I think, has the most unusual style. Because he's sort of similar to Snoop Dogg, where the way he sort of half sings.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a kind of really laid-back, sort of chilled way, but at the same time... It's like he could fucking snap at any minute.
Yeah, no, he sounds like
unhinged.
A crazy motherfucker.
Yeah, just yeah. A bit
Snoop
unhinged.
Is just too chilled.
Yeah.
Whereas ODB is definitely like, what the fuck is wrong with that?
There's mental illness going on there, wasn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately. They're like a family where, I mean, the GZA, the RZA and ODB, they're all cousins.
Oh.
GZA taught RZA to rap, and RZA in turn then taught ODB.
Oh.
To rap, so that they originally formed a group called All In Together Now.
Yes.
In the 80s, just messing about around Brooklyn as kids. They used to go to like block parties and that kind of thing, and just turn up. And ODB was sort of their beatboxer, and then the other two were spitting rhymes.
Yeah, yeah.
To use the popular vernacular. And they were just obsessed with comics, kung fu movies, chess, which seems like a weird one.
Mm. That's the GZA, though, isn't it?
There's a bit
and 5% of philosophy, which is a branch off of Nation of Islam.
They play chess on the tour bus.
They're obsessed with it. I mean, there's the mystery of chess boxing.
Liquid Swords has got a lot about chess on it as well.
And that's how. So Tracy. Last night, brought my attention to what was it called? Steals and what was it? Banks and Steals.
Anything but Words album.
Which is a collaboration album between is it GZA and
Paul Banks
and Paul Banks from Interpol.
I can't imagine that's great. You know,
it was goddamn awful.
There were moments where it's like I can see that idea working, and then it doesn't.
It's weird that it's only 2 years old, 3 years old, and it feels really dated.
Okay.
I thought.
But
it felt like something from the 80s.
Yeah.
To me.
But I believe that they were introduced to each other through their manager because they both love chess.
However, it's not as bad as the other collaboration I watched last night, which was Method Man joining Texas on stage for a version of Say What You Want.
Fucking Texas.
Method Man will be on anything, though.
And he's there with his arm round with Charlene Spiteri.
Is that worse than the track she did with Rammstein?
It's excruciating.
I've not heard either of those.
Oh, Jesus, that's too terrible.
Okay, it's got to be said that when we were starting to talk about the Wu-Tang Clan, I was not expecting Texas to turn up.
No.
That's, I'm always there with the tangents.
Fucking hell.
Well, I mean, there is a Christina Aguilera link, you know, because Redman was on Dirty, wasn't he?
And
Method Man and Redman. Is he a Killer Bee or is he just Method Man's mate?
He's affiliated, but he's not a legit Wu-Tang Killer Bee. He might be a Killer Bee. I'm never sure.
No.
Because it's so fucking convoluted.
It really is.
And difficult to know. And I've got to say, I'm coming at this as an outsider. The only record I own is 36 Chambers. You know, I've liked a lot of the singles I've heard over the years, but it is outside of my area of expertise.
Well, that's it. You won't be surprised to find that I am woefully out of my comfort zone here. you know, I mean, I've listened to Public Enemy and NWA over the years because you can't help but be exposed to them. But hip-hop, rap, it isn't my genre. I can't imagine how shocked you'd be to suddenly find out if I was an expert on gangster rap or hardcore hip-hop.
That'd be fucking hilarious.
But I've just got no starting reference point here.
36 Chambers is a fucking good...
It is, yeah. And I've listened to it in its entire... Well, the expanded edition. And musically... absolutely fine, I can get on with it, but lyrically it's a lot to take in when you don't have the reference points yourself.
Okay.
See, I find it a lot easier to deal with than like West Coast stuff.
Okay.
Because West Coast stuff's definitely a lot more like misogynistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, look at all my money, look at all my
guns.
There
is that.
Whereas Wu-Tang are not. They don't do that.
And really. East Coast tends to be a lot harder as well.
Yeah.
Much more political.
Harder sounding.
Yeah.
You've got you know, I mean, when you've got people like Dr. Dre, there's the G-funk sound. It's taking sort of soul records.
And yeah, it's got a bit of a groove to it. It's like easily, it's catchy, and there's hooks, and it's danceable.
And a lot of the samples and the musical influences that RZA was taking when he was creating
it's like weird jazz records,
it's stuff like Thelonious Monk, so there's weird like atonal piano parts and stuff like that. He's I believe that he tries to keep the sampling down as much as possible. A lot of the tracks are only about 30% samples, and then he plays a bit of piano himself. He's self-taught, so that's why it's sort of weird discordant bits. He uses a Roland MC-909 to strengthen the beats.
Yeah.
So he's always got a drum machine below the breaks that he's sampled, just to make it harder. Because the kick and the snare really fucking kick you in the face.
Yeah.
Particularly on that record.
I mean, I'm happier listening to something like Cypress Hill and much more danceable hip hop, or like the bands we were talking about earlier, the UK bands like the Herbalizer, Cold Cut.
Okay.
With Wu-Tang Clan, there's a whole level of violence and anger.
There is
so
a lot
much,
of violence.
It's harder. you can't listen to it passively.
Hold on. I'd rather listen to Cypress Hill because there's too much violence. How I could just kill a man?
All right. Yep. Somehow it seems a more upbeat
with
violence.
My Glock stuck up his ass like a dildo.
Yes.
You know,
what?
I don't particularly do angry music. I'm not an angry...
I know, Cypress Hill sound way more chilled out when they're talking about
it. They're very,
people.
Very stoned.
You know, I do moody and sulky. I like sad music. Angry, violent music is harder for me to...
I mean, listening to 36 Chambers, particularly that skit on Method Man, which is where they're talking about the
torture, motherfucker,
methods of torture.
The balls on the dresser. And
yes.
Just your nuts on the dresser.
Bat.
Blow! rap skits.
They're a bit weird.
I don't think anybody likes them. I think the artists making them at the time think they're hilarious, and the 13-year-old kids listening to them at the time fucking love them.
Yeah.
But then I wish they were extra tracks so you could just skip them easier rather than stuck on the end of are on the start of of genuinely fantastic songs. I mean, Method Man, what a fucking song. M-O-T-H-O-D, man.
You know, in the way that you reached out to Twitter to say, what am I missing?
Yeah.
About the wedding present, I had something on the Wu-Tang Clan saying, like, oh God, I've got to revise Wu-Tang, you know, shit, this is not, this is, yeah, so out of my comfort zone. And Jake Palmer is one of my Twitter friends, and I mean, he just came back and said that Method Man on Enter the Wu-Tang is as good as it gets if you like that kind of thing, which I do. And I just thought, but I don't.
Fair enough. It's not going to be something that is for everyone.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it works both ways, because I don't think you're going to find many hardcore New York street kids who say, like, The Wedding Present. You're not going to get much from that particular Venn diagram, are you?
Not necessarily, no.
No, I think it's more of a... There's more of a Venn diagram between metal fans and hip-hop fans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely, like, 90s metal.
Do you know what?
Yeah, because of all the rap metal that we were listening
there
to.
There was a 1990 fanzine interview that revealed that David Gedge really likes Napalm Death and Extreme Noise Terror.
Fantastic.
But the thing is, I was wondering, I wonder if Lee Dorian or Phil Vane likes The Wedding Present.
Probably not, no.
Probably not.
But we are talking about the Wu-Tang Clan here.
Yeah.
Ah, yes, but the Wu-Tang Clan reference the second Wedding Present album.
No, they don't. They reference Bizarro,
the
superhero, who is a DC Comics character because they love comics.
No.
Yep, that's 100%.
Get out.
That's why I made that Voltron reference earlier.
Yes.
Because they form like Voltron.
Do you know, I thought maybe though you could do the names, like, So in the bit in Clan in the Front where they reel off the names.
Clan in the Front?
Clan in, yeah, you see, I can't even say, I know.
Just say Clan in the Front.
Yeah, shall I?
Tracy Bowen, the whitest woman alive.
I know. So yeah, they reel off the names, the RZA, the JZA, Old Dirty Bastard, Inspector Deck, Ugod. And I thought, you could do it with a wedding present,
the
actually.
The Ghostface Killer!
You could do it with
We're never fucking ill.
You could do it, the Gedger, the Grapper. Grapper is the nickname of the original guitarist,
right.
So this doesn't work, does it?
No, it doesn't. It's all right. I can cut this bit.
The thing is, it's not that I don't like it. It's not. I'm not being disingenuous about this. It's just the truth. I don't get it.
Yeah. No, I can totally understand that. My dad's the same. My dad doesn't understand it.
And like when I tried to do the playlist, I went for like quite broad, because I only put like 2-3 Wu-Tang tracks on, and then it was like
Wu-related, wasn't it?
Lots of Wu-related, like,
yeah.
I mean, that Ghostface and Czarface,
holy fucking shit, that album's amazing.
Yes, it is.
Czarface versus Ghostface, it's out this year,
yep.
So it will, I'm fucking sure, a track's gonna feature in the end of year best of.
The
production on his fucking Max Cavalera would say killer.
Yes. I love the amount of peripheral stuff, though. Like, because you can dig, you know, like, I'm really only listening to 36 Chambers as far as Wu-Tang stuff is concerned.
Yeah.
But I've listened to so much peripheral stuff. And then I love the fact that there's a toast restaurant called Toast Face Griller. And I love that when it opened, Ghostface Killer turned up and did a set outside it.
That's
because
awesome.
He'd heard
That's
about
cool.
it. I love that. I love all of this little woo stuff. There's a game called Army of Two, which was never particularly well received, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And there's one scene where the two characters are having a massive shootout on this dam, and over their radios, they're talking about the solo albums, like, which was the best solo album? And the one's like, oh, I like Ghostface. But it's like a solid 10-15-minute set piece. And the whole dialogue is about Wu-Tang Clan solo
That's
albums.
Brilliant.
It's fucking amazing.
That is cool.
I mean, it, really, really interesting from a music business point of view. Because they're the first sort of group ever to... They negotiated a contract as Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah.
But they managed to get into their contract that every single member was free to go off and sign their own solo deals.
Right.
So that they
Wu-Tang
was signed with Loud RCA. You got Method Man then signed a solo deal with Def Jam. Raycon was with Loud Records on the same label. Ghostface Killah was on Sony. GZA was on Geffen, and so on.
RZA is a really sound business brand. Yes. Like, he has made them a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because it was him, wasn't it? He was like, look, I've got this plan. Stick with me. We'll be rich.
There's him and his brother. It's either his brother or his brother-in-law.
Yeah.
Who is the manager. Now, there's a four-part documentary series called Wu-Tang of Mics and Men.
Yeah.
That, as we're recording, is being shown at the moment, the sort of two episodes in, but I managed to find all four episodes online. I don't know how, they just sort of fell into my computer. So I watched them all. Yeah. And
I only managed to watch the first
one. I can't remember the RZA's brother's name, but fucking hell, he does not come off well. A lot of the sort of business decisions. So they'd got this brilliant deal where they can all sign off their own things.
Yeah.
But there's been various things where various members have felt that they're not being paid properly. And there's been various court cases and that kind of thing. You can tell that they are not as close as they used to be.
Yeah.
And a lot of the animosity is with this guy who's the manager. The nine remaining guys are all being interviewed quite often in a theatre. So yeah. They're all sitting together. But his interviews are, he's sitting on his yacht.
Mm.
Which obviously doesn't put across.
They did say they only meet up now if they're in the studio or actually touring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, considering a lot of them all grew up together.
Yeah.
They've known him since they were like 6 years old.
Oh, what was actually really funny when they said about how they did grow up together, he said, like, you know, they said our mums knew each other. I'm not sure our dads did.
Nice.
Quite another sort of interesting way of how they sort of got themselves known on the scene, because there was nine of them.
Yeah.
And they were, a lot of the time in the early days, it wasn't just Ghostface. A lot of them had sort of masks on.
Yeah.
Bandanas over their face, and
because
it was a kind of, you know, gangstery type scene. They just used to turn up at shows and get on stage, and they just used to wrestle the microphones off other people, and they'd do a set, which must be fucking horrible if you were the other bands. But
yeah, yeah.
They got themselves really well known for it. And then when they released the debut single, which I think was Protect Your Neck.
It was indeed.
The local radio station that played hip-hop in the New York area, they broke in while this show was on air. They just,
so, like Airheads then?
Yes. They just turned up in the studio and made them play the record. It was just a white label, and they played it. And then I don't think they even announced who it was.
What was the bit in the?
So they then used to take it into record shops and play it for people, and people would be going, "Fucking hell, that's the record that I heard." And they'd end up selling all the
in
copies.
In the documentary, the way they were staging the selling of the first act record.
Yeah, that was the bit.
Like, yeah, taken up. Yeah.
Yeah, so they then just took it round the record shops, and it just, by word of mouth, sort of built up around the scene.
Really inventive. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know, a punk DIY sort of thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, hip-hop is very fucking punk rock.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly around New York. I think there was a lot more... I think the West Coast scene is a lot more,
it's just that
less
I don't,
organic.
I just don't think I'm their target audience.
No. You've never been a teenage boy.
I feel like their target audience is everyone who will buy their things.
Yeah.
So that's the thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, some of the tracks are massive pop.
Yeah, like Gravel Pit is
exactly
entirely,
later on,
undeniably a massive pop song.
Yes. Where they're all in... dressed up as the Flintstones in the video.
Yep.
ODB, unfortunately, sadly not with us anymore.
Yeah.
But he's had a lot of run-ins with the law over the years, and I've always loved the story. It's not good for him because it doesn't work out well, but he'd had some kind of criminal case where the court had sentenced him to rehab.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that he'd voluntarily gone to rehab. He fucking had to go to rehab, even if he said no. And he managed to break out of rehab about 2 weeks before the end of his rehab sentence.
Right.
Spent a month on the run, just hiding all over the place. And then, this was in 2000, they were releasing The W, which was their album that came out then. And they had a record release party in New York, and he turned up on stage with them, which obviously alerted the police to the general area where he was.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that the police were not watching what the Wu-Tang Clan were doing.
Seems like the first place you'd look, isn't it?
Miraculously, he was not arrested on that night.
How
he got
the fuck
away
did
again.
That happen?
I don't know how. He then got arrested, I think it was a couple of weeks later in Philadelphia, while signing autographs in McDonald's. Oh, God.
What a fucking legend.
And then there's also, the big news over the last sort of 5 years or so, which is actually, fucking hell, it's 5 years ago now. It just doesn't seem like that long ago.
Mm.
They released an album called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin.
That's the one that there's one copy of.
One copy. They made it was their first album in years. They made one copy. They wanted it. They wanted basically to make it as a statement. Well, I'm saying they. RZA wanted to make this record as a statement of it was an art piece.
Yeah.
So his thoughts were that you make it, you know, that there's not loads of different copies of the Mona Lisa. There's not loads of different copies of, you know, Michelangelo's David.
Yeah.
They would make this one record, just have one copy, where it was a handcrafted silver and nickel box, not nickel bag.
Yeah.
And then they auctioned it. The way he'd made it was a little bit shady. He'd basically gone around just getting people to, the rest of the band to just record little bits, not really telling them what it was for. They did not know that it was for a new Wu-Tang album. As far as they knew, it might be just for a solo album that RZA was putting together. And then he put this album together in secret, auctioned it off to the highest bidder, which it was eventually sold for $2 million to Martin Shkreli, who was very well known at the time because he's a sort of hedge fund.
Oh, shit, he was that guy, wasn't he?
Yep.
He's a scumbag.
He's basically ran a drug company, pharmacy company.
Massively overinflating the prices of really important necessary drugs.
Yeah, there was one particular drug that was essential for, it was an anti-parasitic drug that people with HIV pretty much needed to survive. Now, when he took this on, they cost $13.50 a tablet.
Yep.
He then increased the price overnight to $750 for one tablet. Which, the way the American medical system works, meant that people could not access that medicine and probably died.
Basically a death sentence.
Incidentally, just as a scathing indictment on the American medical system, comparative prices around the rest of the world, it costs less than 10 cents for a tablet everywhere else. So America was fucking people over in the first place, but this guy took it to the fucking nth degree.
And he has this one copy.
He's played certain sections of it while live streaming on Twitch, because he's that kind of cunt. Just before he then got arrested for contempt of court and stuff like that.
Right.
He's now in jail. But the police didn't seize the Wu-Tang record because they didn't have a warrant to seize goods.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Which is a shame, because if the police had seized it, they could have then released it.
Yep.
But the rest of the clan do not see it as a Wu-Tang album. they don't recognise it. And in the documentary, there's a bit where they're all sitting in the theatre discussing it, and you've got RZA sitting in the front being very, very quiet while the rest of them are going, I don't even want to fucking talk about that piece of shit and stuff like that. There's a lot of tension in that bit.
Mm.
So, Colin, I believe you have a game.
Well, yes. Wu-Tang Clan, the various members, have very different names. They have lots of aliases. So, Ian probably knows most of these, so I think what we will do... Well, what we will do is Tracy gets the first guess.
Yep.
And then Ian gets the second guess each time. I think we should call this Wu-Tang or Nu-Tang. what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you a name. You have to tell me whether it is a real Wu-Tang name.
Honestly, couldn't we have done Wu Are You?
Wu Are You?
And
that
then,
works.
Then
Wu Are You? Wu, 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 Wu.
Ooh, tell me, yeah. Wu Are You?
Yeah, that works. Fuck yeah. Okay.
I'll go with the first one.
Right, so I'm going to read some names. Tracy, you have the first answer. Then Ian gets the next answer, and then I'll tell you if we're right. Bobby Digital.
Nu-Tang.
Nu-Tang?
Nu-Tang.
What do you think, Wu-Tang or Nu-Tang?
The RZA.
It is indeed the RZA.
Oh,
it's a fucking great album.
It is, yeah.
I don't know, is it Fall Out Boy?
Mudbutt McMurder.
Oh, surely Nu-Tang.
No, that's Wu-Tang.
Yeah, it's ODB.
That's
it?
ODB.
Oh, for fuck's sake. See, I've done my research, as you can tell.
Tikalian Stallion. Wu-Tang or Nu-Tang?
Nu-Tang.
Method Man. Right?
That's Method Man.
I was just thinking, like, surely there aren't going to be three in a row.
Come on, I put a track from Tikal, his solo album, on.
And I paid about probably as much attention as you did to the wedding present playlist.
Tony Starks.
Nu-Tang, that's from Iron Man, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but Ghostface Killer took that name. Actually, it's Tony Stark, but he's called it Tony Starks.
Thank
sorry,
you for
Ian.
Giving me a guess there.
I'm sorry.
I'd probably have gone for GZA, though, to be honest.
Yeah, that was Ghostface, who also goes under the name Iron Man as well.
Of course
he makes
does.
Makes sense. Rolly Fingers.
But just because I've been wrong every time so far, I'm going to go Wu-Tang with that one.
What do you think, Ian?
Because I haven't got a clue.
No.
That's Inspector Deck.
Fuck
it is.
Hell.
So far, all of these have been. Master System.
Nu-Tang.
Oh, I think that's Master Killer.
No, that's one I made up for Master Killer.
Shit. That was too obvious. I should have.
Yeah. Wallaby Kingpin.
What? What? Nu-Tang.
It solidly sounds like another ODB one.
No, it's Ghostface.
Fucking hell.
Old Dirty Chinese Restaurants.
We've got plenty of them in Tamworth. Nu-Tang.
That is definitely an ODB one, isn't it?
It is, but it was. I believe that name was given to him by Dave Chappelle in a sketch, and then he adopted it,
yep.
Which is excellent. I think I'll just go with reading what I've got on here.
Yeah.
So, the RZA, Robert Fitzgerald Diggs, his real name. Legitimate names, Prince Rakim, the Abbot, Bobby Digital, Bobby Steels, the Scientist, Prince Delight, Prince Dynamite, Ruler Zigzag Zigala, and Resurrector.
Resurrector is his name in Gravediggers.
And not Prince of Persia, which is what I put down as one to read out.
Okay.
The GZA, also known as Gary Grice. Can I just... I think we need some kind of respect here for the fact that we've said the name GZA a lot of the time.
Without laughing. Yes.
Yeah, I'm proud of you both.
I always, in my head, pronounce it GZA.
Yeah.
Well, I did. I actually had to write in my notes GZA.
Yeah.
Yep.
To make sure I pronounced it
so,
right.
So, GZA, the genius, Justice, Maximilian, and not Garry Kasparov. I put that on there. Old Dirty Bastard, this is the one with the most nicknames.
Obviously.
ODB, Dirt McGirt, Dirt Dog, Big Baby Jesus, Sweet Baby Jesus, Mudbutt McMurder, Osiris, Cyrus the Father, Joe Bananas, King Bong, Rob Dog, Old Dirt Schultz, Hassan, Old Dirty Chinese Restaurant, Ill Irving the Murderer, The Bizzer, Old Daddy Skid Marks, The Drunken Master Styles, A-Sun Jones, A-Sun Unique, Rain Man, Freeloading Rusty, The Man of All Rainbows, and Not Jeebus Criminal.
Baby Jesus is my favourite.
Yeah.
Although I quite like Daddy Skidmark.
Yeah. Old Daddy Skidmark.
Sorry.
Method Man, real name Clifford Smith. Meth, Methical, Shaquan, Mizza, Iron Lung, Hot Nichols, Tikalian Stallion, Johnny Blaze, and not Mr. Tikal. Raekwon, Corey Woods, known as The Chef, for two reasons: his lyrical flavour and also his skill at cooking cocaine into crack rocks.
Fantastic.
Ray, Shala Raekwon, Lex Diamonds, Lou Diamonds, and not Ann Diamond. Ghostface Killer, real name Dennis Coles. Ghost, Sun God, Iron Man, Tony Starks, Starkey Love, Pretty Tony, P-Tone, Ghost Danny, The Wallaby Kingpin, and not Egon Spengler. Inspector Deck, real name Jason Hunter. Rebel Ins, Fifth Brother, Rory Fingers, and not Inspector Gadget. You God, real name Lamont Jody Hawkins. Baby You, Golden Arms, Four Bar Killer, Lucky Hands. Master Killer, High Chief, real name Elgin Turner. High Chief, Noodles. And Capadonna, real name Daryl Hill, has only got one other nickname, and that's Cappuccino.
Nice.
So with the Wu-Tang names, old internet thing that people may remember from about sort of 15, 16 years ago, there was a Wu-Tang name generator.
Okay.
Which Childish Gambino
is Donald Glover's Wu name.
Yeah, Donald Glover got his Childish Gambino name by putting it into this website, and that's
excellent.
What it came up with. So I've put our names. There's a couple of different versions.
Yep.
So
you've got the original one. I have got the one that is currently residing on the Wu-Tang Clan's website.
Yes. So I put my name in, and it came up with Scratching Profit.
And you got Buddhist Bibulous.
I can dig that.
Yep.
Ian, on the one that I tried, was Thunderous Menace.
And I've got Mercenary Lazy Ass.
Excellent. Tracy, I got down as Shrieking Destroyer.
Well, that's pretty good, you know.
Ooh, yeah. I like that.
Ian's just typing it into his phone.
Wildcat Foolish, which is also pretty fucking cool.
No, I'm going to change my Twitter.
On one of the old ones, I got Asthmatic Enemy of God, which I thought was quite good.
I think I'm going to change my Twitter name to Shrieking Destroyer.
Yeah, I've also put Rasputin in here. Rasputin, the podcast, is Tough Mastermind.
Nice.
Tough, obviously, spelled T-U-F-F.
Of course.
And We Dig Music, I put in, which comes up as Fearless Warlock.
Nice.
So we're fucking changing the podcast name.
Fearless Warlock.
Yeah, I also put my daughter's name in it. Hilariously came up with Sarcastic Overlord, which is fucking accurate.
Wow, I put in Rasputin Clark, and he is Demon Threatening.
That's
is
accurate,
he ever?
Man. That is fully accurate. Yeah.
My ex-girlfriend, when this came out, like the Woo thing, was called Bastard Harbormaster.
I remember that.
Fucking amazing. I was so bummed out. I'm like, yeah, I'm Asthmatic Enemy of God. That's awesome. Let's see what yours is. Bitch. That is so much cooler than mine.
Does she now have a successful hip-hop career?
Sadly not. But, like, she was from the coast. So,
she's,
you know,
true.
She could be a harbour master.
Is that Laura?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah. So, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Fuck you, I'm a Shrieking Destroyer.
You need to change your Twitter name, definitely.
Yeah.
Amazing. I think we're about done there.
Yes, I think we are.
I think so.
So, next episode is actually the last one of this series,
so,
Alphabet Series.
It's going to about wrap things up then.
Yes. Not that we'll be taking a break, we'll be starting straight up after that.
The series three.
But we will be discussing Yo La Tengo.
Woo!
And ZZ Top.
Yay.
Yeah. We've been We Dig Music. Thanks for listening.
We Dig Music ain't nothing to fuck with.
Indeed.
We Dig Music ain't nothing to fuck with.
We Dig Killer Bees. Gonna swarm. Yeah. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Something else that was in that Q&A session, this is just something you'll be interested in as an aside, Andrew Jezzard, the director, he went down and met...
Andrew the Jizzer.
The Rizzer. The Jizzer.
He went down and met Sheila Ravenscroft.
Yeah, because she's in the documentary.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course, you saw that bit. But anyway, so while they were doing that interview, you know they run the Peel Centre.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's completely a voluntary run thing.
Where was that gig? Was that at the Peel Centre that you went to?
No, there was the footage was from two gigs. I was at the Leeds gig, right. But no, there was footage from the Peel Centre. No, because so she's heavily involved with it, and like it's just run by volunteers. And yeah. There was someone there that didn't know how to turn the lights on or something, so she had to go down, and she left Jezzard alone, and he was there for about 45 minutes, just him and Peel's record collection.
Holy shit!
And he was like, it was amazing. I mean, did you see
yeah.
that archive system?
Yeah.
Oh my God.